Welcome to Phantom Astronaut. I'd like to thank all of the Phantom Astronaut patrons for supporting the show. If you enjoy the podcast and would like to support the show, visit phantomastronaut.com for all the different ways that you can help us continue to create. Today, I'm joined by essayist, critic, and author of The Death of the Artist, William Dresewitz. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. I'm thrilled to have you on here. I've been following your talks, your books, everything for at least a couple of years. And some things that the audience may not really know about me. They know me, of course, from hosting this show. They know me from my social feeds. They know me from my artwork, but they may not know how involved I am in working with young artists, working with students. I created an immersive media program for artists at University of Maryland. I created a similar program and taught that program for several years at Columbia College Chicago, been on advisory boards with Stevens Institute of Technology. I was on an AI ethics committee with a project at Carnegie Mellon back in the early 2000s that was involving, you know, all kinds of interesting artistic aspects. And, you know, even down to the stuff that I do with the Television Academy, it's internship season. So I'm on a committee and we're going through and we're looking at, you know, prospective media interns for the entertainment industry and, you know, kind of figuring all that out. And something that I wanted to bring you on to talk about a little bit, because I've seen your work cross over into this so much, is the academic world preparing these students, these young artists in whatever creative field they may be in, to deal with our current moment? Because when I deal with these students, when I talk to these young people, a lot of them are just completely freaked out. They're a little bit like a deer in the headlights, and they feel like the school has not prepared them for the realities of what the creative labor market is, you know, globally in the current time. I don't know if that's something that you've been experiencing or had people come up to you to talk about, but that's what I'm getting.
Yeah, well, I talked about this in The Death of the Artist, my book about the arts economy, specifically the arts economy as individual creators experience it in the age of the internet. I have a chapter on art school. I talked to a lot of people about this. I should say that I did most of the reporting for that book in 2017. So that's already a few years ago. I don't have any reason to think, and you just gave me more reason to not think that anything has changed since 2017. And what people said to me then was that the schools, and this has always been true for art schools, they do not prepare students for the financial realities they're going to face. They either think everything is going to work out fine, or they're clueless themselves. You know, the professors may have been professors now for many years and may have lost touch with the market, or they may be aware, but they don't know what to tell their students, or they don't think it's their problem. Some people will even say that. They may not say it out loud. So students come in, as you just suggested, you know, part of the problem with creative field, and I have deep love and deep gratitude in my heart for creators who have made my life so much richer and do so on a daily basis. But part of the problem with creative fields is that they tend to involve wildly optimistic expectations. People know their favorite artists, but who generally speaking are successful, often extremely successful, and they think that that's the norm. They think that they have a realistic shot at achieving that kind of success. This is just not true. I mean, the numbers are brutal. It's almost not an exaggeration to say that it's about like playing the lottery. And at the best, and I talk about this a lot in The Death of the Artist, even what you would call a successful artist, which in my definition is you can work as an artist full-time in your field, you're not necessarily going to make a lot of money. You're not necessarily going to make enough money even, say, to raise kids. You can work, but you can work. Even that is a pretty small fraction of all the people who go into creative field. And to get back to your question, the schools are just really, for the most part, not dealing with this.
Yeah. I had a little bit of maybe a better education on this than most people who come into the arts, because I'm the third generation of artist in my family. And that actually goes back to something that's a bit unusual. My grandmother was a designer. So post-World War II, she was working designing textiles and advertising and things like that. It was very unusual for the time period. And she met my grandfather, who was working at the design firm. He was in the film development lab. And so, you know, they were always a two-income family in, you know, post-war America, which is, you know, you think about, you know, that being like the height of the earning power and everything like that. But the creative fields have always sort of lagged behind, unfortunately, in those ways. My father was a painter, fine art painter. And my mother started out, you know, doing a lot of pottery. Eventually, she sort of transitioned into running resort hotels and things like that. And it, you know, allowed our family to have a much higher standard of living. But, you know, myself and my wife, you know, I augment my income with teaching and things like we just talked about and, you know, whatever else. So my inherited knowledge was always one that the arts are difficult financially.
Yeah.
And I try to impart that onto students and people who kind of come into my sphere. And it's interesting that there's a little bit of almost a mythologized, you know, kind of thing about it, where no matter how many times I tell this to people, and this is all anecdotal, of course, but I was just talking to somebody on Threads the other day where she said that she told me that her friend group, who are illustrators, aspiring illustrators, they genuinely believed that if they were able to get a job working on Marvel movies, that they would be set for life, that they would be, you have $1 million or whatever else. They got into the field. They realized that this is an unorganized, no union, you know, kind of Wild West situation. They're making pennies on the dollar. And a lot of them are laid off for long stretches between projects. And she was horrified because they'd absorbed this idea that big brands, large capitalist interest, Disney, whatever else, Apple, these companies will take care of their workers. And if you're able to get into these companies, that's like your golden ticket. So I don't know where that propaganda comes. I'm sure it touches on a million things, but it seems to be a really prevalent idea in people that are under 25 right now. It scares me a little bit.
I didn't know that, and that scares me a great deal. Yeah, these corporations are not going to take care of you. This is not the 1950s. You're not going to be working for, you know, Ford Motor Company and be in the UAW. Employment, as you just suggested, it tends to be temporary. It tends to be, you know, gig work. And it also it doesn't matter how much the corporations are making. It doesn't mean that they're paying you a six-figure salary. You know, they pay as little as they have to. And as you just said, they tend to be ununionized. That idea that you're going to reach some point, whether it's because you're going to work for Disney or whatever, and it's the point at which you quote-unquote make it. I talk about this in the book, and people talked about it with me. There's no make it point. Certainly not for, you know, I mean, maybe if you get one of the very small and shrinking number of tenured jobs at an art school, and you know, then there is an institution that's really going to take care of you. But I mean, again, creative work, it's one freelance gig at a time. And when that's over, it's over. And even if you bank what sounds like a lot of money, even like, I don't know, you write a novel and, you know, a debut novel that gets a big advance, a few $100,000. So first of all, it takes you a few years to write it. That's not in addition to some salary you're getting from your job because you don't have a job. And then also once that's over, you know, okay, so maybe it floated you for half a decade, but then what? So, I mean, we can get into this more, but you need to understand the economic landscape much differently, and you need to understand how you're going to deal with it much differently than if you have in your mind this model of, I'm going to get a job or somehow make it in some other way, and then I'm going to be set, because that's not how it works.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think one thing that you touched on earlier in the conversation about some educators maybe bringing in these inherited ideas where they feel a little bit frozen in time. Like, well, this was how the market was when I entered academia, so this is just how I know the market to be. And they don't update that worldview in a dynamic enough way to address the issues of the current economy. I worry about that constantly, because if we look at even just the last couple of months, we've got people being laid off in PlayStation. I think there was like Sony laid off 9,000 plus people just recently. If you look at, again, even from this month, I think Vice.com said that they're no longer going to be publishing on their site. That's putting not only writers out of potential work, but it's putting illustrators and, you know, other people associated with that out of work. Same thing with Pitchfork. Music site has been shuttered. And, you know, that kind of compounds on top of all of these other things. You know, Netflix laid off thousands and thousands of people recently. There is a contraction of the creative industries.
Los Angeles Times and the journalism industry continues.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's a really devastating time for young people to be entering this field. And I'm going to be honest with you, I don't know. I don't have any advice for them, because things just seem to be like, it's like a rowboat that's filling with water, and we're bailing, but we're not seeming to make any headway. How would an educator even begin to broach this with people when the information is coming in so fast and furious to us?
It's tough. So, like I said, I have a whole chapter about this in the book. I would say, first of all, that schools tend to go in one of two directions. One we've talked about, where they ignore the economic realities that their students are going to face, and they're holding on either to an old version of the job market or to this very old version of artistic purity, where you shouldn't even talk about money, and somehow the world is going to recognize your talents and just give you money. Or they go in the opposite direction, where they make their program intensely market oriented in a way that can be, that often is very narrow and, you know, very like too specific to really be useful for more than just like this minute. So I mentioned the School of Visual Arts in New York, you know, the sort of venerable old art school. As of the 1990s, it had like 4 master's programs. And as of the time I reported the book, it had like 20 something master's programs. And most of them were these very specific attempts to like surf the waves of the economy. So for one thing, you're not really preparing students for anything past maybe their first job. And then they're just going to be helpless after that, because what you're teaching them is too specific. But also, it's like you're having them sell out from the beginning. You're just giving up on the idea that the whole reason you want to get into this thing is because you think you might have something to express, something unique to say. So the real challenge, I mean, in some sense, either of those options is easy because they're not balancing each other. And the real challenge is to try to thread the needle between the two of them and to develop students who are actual artists, in the sense of people who have a voice and a passion to say something unique in the world, but also prepare them to actually be able to do it financially. How do you do both of those things together? It's not an easy question. I don't have an easy answer for it. But I think of all the people I talked to about this, the one that I found most persuasive, deepest, most inspiring, was someone who's taught at Cal Arts and UC Santa Cruz, and was apparently the first person to teach a class in arts entrepreneurship. It was at CalArts, back before the term even existed. And it was a process of discovery for her, too, because she had come from Hollywood. She was a producer. She thought she was going to be teaching nuts and bolts, which obviously you should be teaching students, the nuts and bolts of how does this thing actually work that I'm going out into. But she found that in order to do that, she had to go farther and farther back and start with a real process of self-exploration for the students. Why do I want to do this in the first place? Which is a surprisingly rare question in art school. It's sort of taken for granted. I talked to someone else who's on the faculty of the University of Michigan School of Art, and she said that there'll sometimes be scripts in undergraduate studio classes where, you know, one of the professors asks a student a question like that. Like, what, you know, what is it? And they'll just burst into tears because they don't have an answer. So you start with that. You start with, what do I want to say and why do I want to say it? And then she helps students do actual research in the sense, like researching the field, like name a few, you know, list a few artists whose work you admire, whose careers you'd like to emulate, and find out how do they support themselves. And it may be commercially, it may be through the nonprofit world, you know, foundations, grants, residencies, and so forth. Basically, it's about finding your audience. This is a really important principle that a lot of people talk to me about. You have to think in terms of creating something of value for other people and figuring out who those other people are going to be or are, and then figuring out how to reach them. You can't just kind of wander into the world and hope that money finds you. This doesn't negate what you said about the rowboat. It doesn't mean it's easy. But the whole reason I wrote The Death of the Artist was not to figure out whether times were tough for artists, because it was obvious to me that they are. It was to figure out how, given that they're tough, that artists are actually managing to keep their nostrils above the water, because they are. I talked to well over 100 people. Very few of them were making a lot of money, but almost all of them were supporting themselves as artists. We can talk again. We can talk more about specifics, but that's what I would say at this point.
Mm. Yeah, I tend to agree with you. You know, I that's how I have tried to manage my career, was actually through a similar process of just kind of trying to figure out how other people who did similar things were able to kind of cobble together a living. So I find that to be very personally true. And I'm glad that, you know, is supported in, you know, in your research. One thing that I get concerned about, I'm not even sure how I feel about it, but I guess concern is the best way I can articulate it, is we have a lot of technology companies, especially social media, and what they do is they come out with a new product, and it seems like the first group that they always try to court are young artists, whatever that can be, either visual art, photography, you know, acting, comedy, writers, whatever it is, anything creative, because to them, that is content, that is product, and they would like free product. And what they offer in exchange is this great idea of algorithmic curation, and we're going to connect you with those people that you're talking about. When you say find right. your audience, this is almost this magic quick fix to that has been sort of thrown around for at least the last 15 years. And what I'm starting to see is artists realizing that, number one, they're making money for massive corporations with very little return for themselves. And that once the market is sort of saturated with creative content, those algorithms, which are the other half of the bargain, that they're going to connect you with possible supporters, customers, whatever you want to call them, stop functioning very well. And they're not getting those results, and they're not translating into people who are collecting and patronizing you. So I'm not sure what you do in that situation where you're again a young person and you're like, well, how do I find that audience? Well, these are the tools that are usually most often put forward to you. But it seems a little bit like they're a mirage in the desert a lot of times.
I wish I could disagree with you. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, yes, giant corporations have carved up the internet and have created a situation in which you almost have to go through them to reach and build and maintain any kind of audience. The second thing is that they pay artists little or nothing. You know, as somebody put it to me, somebody's been in the music business for a long time, a musician, you know, it's become conventional to dump on the label system and how evil the suits were or are. I think that that's a real distortion. And one of the reasons I think that is that, as he put it, the labels, once they find you, they invest in you. The platforms expect you to invest in them. Right? It's exactly what you just said. You're producing content and putting it out there. They're not giving you a thin dime. Maybe if it's a music streaming service, they're giving you fractions of a penny per stream. I should say that of all the musicians I talk to, and I would ask people, like, so tell me how you make your money. Like, give me the specifics, give me the numbers. None of the musicians even told me about revenue from streaming until I asked them, because it's such an insignificant part of what they got, you know, maybe a few hundred dollars a year. But again, I mean, what do you do? Okay, so they're not going to pay you. You're creating content that fattens up their bottom line. But what are the alternatives? You know, it's going to be different from artist to artist and from field to field. I still think it's unfortunately true that the main way that you build your audience is by putting out content all the time on these platforms. I mean, that's how everybody I talk to, pretty much, not everybody, but most people I talk to do it. So now I guess that would mean TikTok, that would mean Instagram. It used to mean Twitter, depending on, you know, what kind of thing you're involved in. YouTube, obviously very important. And it's a process that generally doesn't produce any visible results for a while, maybe for several years. Somebody said you kind of just have to have a zen attitude towards tweeting. You know, this was back a few years ago, and she was talking about writers in particular. You just kind of have to tweet into the ether until something clicks. You know, Patreon, Kickstarter, really important. I don't think these things ever exist in a vacuum. I mean, at the same time, you are doing other things to build an audience, you know, so you are, I mean, the specifics are always different, so maybe it would be hard to talk about specifics, but if you're a musician, you're playing shows. How do you get to play shows? Well, you're networking with other bands who might want to have you on the bill. You're reaching out to the appropriate sized venues in 50 different cities around the country as you try to put together a tour that you're going to, you know, drive around in a van for. Maybe, depending again on what your field is, you teach classes, you teach workshops, you produce some kind of physical object that, you know, like if you're a visual artist, like something that you can put an image on, a mug, a calendar, that is not subject to the economics of the internet, right? It's a physical object. And most important of all, it's going to be different for everybody, and it's going to be changing all the time. So you have to know the market. You have to constantly stay in touch with what the possibilities are. It's a giant pain in the ass. It shouldn't have to be this way, because art is still generating tens of billions of dollars a year. Okay, recorded music, you know, the official revenue is like a third of what it was before Napster, but it's still generating tens of billions of dollars. It's just that money is going mainly to the platforms. They're not sharing it.
No, absolutely. This kind of touches on what we were talking about earlier about creative entrepreneurship, where from my personal experience, having a studio that does creative work for a lot of, you know, other businesses. And these are some of the people that I even called out earlier. These are like, you know, Disney and Warner Brothers and people like that. And I kind of try to separate my online identity a little bit from that work that I do in the studio, because again, it's work for hire. It's, you know, it's part of the market. It's just, you know, it is what it is. It's not necessarily art as we discussed it, about having a vision, a point of view, and, you know, being very personal. Now, getting into that creative field, get that playing at that level, that takes its own financial investment. Part of the reason that, you know, I'm able to take these bigger jobs is because I am now essentially underwriting Disney. I am underwriting Warner Brothers. I am absorbing a certain amount of cost up front to say, okay, if they want to build a physical immersive experience, I'm, as the contractor and, you know, the business owner, I'm saying, okay, well, I'm going to hire this many people. I'm going to do, you know, I'm going to have these materials printed. I'm going to have, you know, laborers help me build this thing. And it's very difficult. So sometimes I've noticed this over the past 10 years, it's gone from me sending in my invoices, you know, net 30. And even now, if I say net 30, some of these bigger companies, these multinational companies, they'll come back and they go, oh, well, we don't do that. Well, we do net 90. So now I may be on the hook for paying $50,000 out of my own pocket, $100,000 out of my own pocket, while they wait out the quarter to do their earnings. They're doing this to me and 100 other vendors, you know, that looks better for that department's bottom line. So it is a little bit skewed, and I think that there needs to be a lot of financial literacy about the risk that's involved in, you know, in these jobs. It's not like they're going to magically come to you and, you know, take care of all of your expenses and things. It's still the same kind of vendor relationship as if I was supplying them with styrofoam cups or whatever they use for the theme parks, right? You know, it is a business. And in addition to that, when we look at the music side, one thing that we didn't really touch on, which is this sort of gray area replacement for the record labels, which is private investment. And I've known a lot of bands who another partner that I do a lot of podcasts with, he used to be the rock buyer for Tower Records. He has managed bands and he's facilitated some of these deals where a private investor will come in with short-term financing because there are upfront fees and costs and things associated with becoming like an opening act on a big tour. For example, You have to guarantee that you're going to spend enough money or have enough money to fulfill your obligations as the opening act. You are a vendor for the headliner. So it's, I think this environment where we don't discuss the financial aspects of what it takes to run a business, an artistic business, even at sort of like this mid-tier level, is doing everybody a disservice.
This is very interesting. Let me pull out a few things that you just said. So first of all, you talked about the fact that a lot of your work, and certainly a lot of your money, comes from commercial work and work that you separate from your more artistic work. This is extremely common. I've spent some of the last 2 or 3 years doing a ghostwriting project. Most of the money that I've made for the last 2 or 3 years has come from a ghostwriting project. I never thought I would do this. I haven't particularly wanted to do it. And I mean, I wrote a bestseller 10 years ago. I just turned 60, okay? So I would say get over yourself. If you're resistant to the idea of doing this kind of commercial work, everybody does it. Nobody talks about it. Yes, you know, you feel like you're selling your soul. I think that's kind of silly. But at the very least, you know, there's your soul over here. And using the talents that you've developed as an artist to make some kind of more commercial money. Another thing that we haven't talked about at all, and that is certainly, I would say, not only extremely common, but almost ubiquitous for very young artists, and even not so young artists, is that you're going to do work that has nothing to do with your art at all. You're going to have a day job. And, you know, we don't need to go through all of those options, but, you know, again, it comes with the territory. You need to deal with it, and you need to find a way to save enough energy to still make your work. You know, including emotional energy and so forth. But what you were talking about in particular is really interesting too. And I would generalize it a little bit. I mean, what I think you said, you know, it's a business, and I believe you were referring to yourself, not the businesses that you're. Yeah, okay. So I talk about this in the book, like what is an artist economically? Because, you know, there's this nebulous term, creative entrepreneur. What the hell does that mean? People on the left who are engaged in the art. We'll talk about artists as workers, which I think is appropriate, but it's not quite accurate. I mean, sometimes artists do function as workers. What you really are is a single person small business.
Right.
Functioning in a capitalist environment. And the capitalist environment means that you need to capitalize yourself. You need to have some kind of investment in yourself, make some kind of investment in yourself. People don't think of it this way, but going to art school or maybe even just going to college and studying art or not studying art is a form of investing in yourself. And you have to find the money, borrow the money. How do you get the money? This is what Kickstarter is for, right? If you're signed with a label or a publisher, they will give you an advance. They're capitalizing you. They're giving you the money to do your work. If you can't, you know, get a deal like that, that's what something like Kickstarter is. But thinking of it this way, I think helps clarify how the process works, right? I didn't know about private music investment. I mean, it sort of makes sense. It's also kind of like, wow.
Yeah, it's high interest. In my personal opinion, the loan terms are a little predatory. It's kind of like emergency gap funding, but you know, for people that are, you know, they may have had like a mild hit single and they need to get on the road. They need to start making some money. And, you know, one way to do it is to get on a big tour and they need you know, to show the tour operation, the promoters, that, you know, they have a certain amount of money and they hope that it will recoup plus profit. But it's an interesting industry that's developing in the gap of this lack of those traditional record company deals.
It's interesting, and I don't mean to quibble about terminology, but it doesn't actually sound like you're investing it. I mean, investment would be, here, we're going to give
that's
you this
true.
Lump
yes,
of money.
That's true. That's true.
And
yes,
we're going to take a certain percentage of your profit.
In loan sharking, I was using a polite term.
Well, that's the thing, right? That's the thing. It's not an investment. It's a loan. It's a bridge loan. What kind of rates do they charge?
I don't believe it's regulated as a specific industry.
It's not regulated.
I mean, it's I don't know how they mess it around, but they can charge whatever the absolute maximum that you can charge for anything like a payday loan or car title loan. They, you know, anything on that far stretch, I'm sure that they can put in there.
That's tough.
I know that's like flabbergasting, but to kind of refocus it back, it's understanding the financial side of operating your small business, you know, as an artist or group of artists, is crucial, because this is all the same kind of issues that you're going to face if you were opening even something like a turnkey fast food franchise or whatever it is. I mean, all of these things are functionally the same within the eye of capitalism. And if you are completely illiterate to them, then I think that artists get themselves in a lot of trouble.
Yes, indeed. I mean, one of the best interviews I had about this, and I quote extensively from this in the book, it was a guy who had been in the music business for well over 20 years at that point. And he spent, from when he was a kid playing in a band. And he told me, 10 years in, I wasn't getting anywhere. And I realized that I should stop blaming the music industry and start realizing that I needed to figure this out. And he told me he read 300 books on business and related fields. And he's the one who said, you have to understand what you're doing in terms of creating value for other people. This can't just be what you feel like doing. He also very clearly articulated, you have to be in touch with the market at all times. He said that his musician friends who were successful, they acted like they were in a technology industry, because they were, in the sense that things are changing all the time and you need to be aware of it. And he said, and I thought of him because of the last thing you just said, that one of the things he learned is that most people start businesses in what he called an entrepreneurial fit. I mean, I think a lot of food businesses are like this. I really want to do this, but they're not necessarily equipped to do the business side. And most small businesses fail. The way I reformulated this in the book is that it's no more reasonable to expect that every artist is going to be a businessman than it would be to expect that every businessman is going to be an artist.
Mm.
But look, I mean, there's been a lot of doom and gloom so far in this conversation, and I don't think that's avoidable. But I also want to be clear that my purpose in writing about this, and I think your purpose in wanting to talk about this, is to help equip artists to deal with the reality, not to discourage people.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, the more you know what you're facing, the better the chances are that you'll be able to navigate it successfully.
Mm. And I think that's, I've been making a series of posts over the last couple of weeks that I've got to redo my message a little bit. I was doing a little bit of, trying to shock people, shock value stuff. But the posts that I've been making, it's been a lot about AI and AI image generation, which is a big topic of conversation among lots of artistic fields right now. And, part of what the conversation always sort of devolves into is, oh, well, AI doesn't have the soul of an artist, and you're not putting the same kind of this and that into the work, the physical feel of the paper and this. And I go, okay, well, that's all very flowery and everything. But, at the end of the day, you're talking about doing your main job. I've looked up your profile. You're a graphic designer, and you're working and you're making like penny saver ads and things like that for local regional websites and social media. I mean, you've already kind of romanticized the process to a certain point. And I think that there is actually a lot of value for adopting the use of certain AI tools. And I advocate for the ones that are free and open source for people. I don't think that artists shouldn't be investing tons of money into like subscription plans and things to use them. But I advocate for them to figure out how they can integrate them. Because when we talked earlier about social media to me is this fiery engine, like on an old steam locomotive, and it just needs coal all the time. You need to be just dumping things in there. And, you know, as an artist, that's very, very difficult to accomplish. And I think that if you are somebody who recognizes that your social feed is not necessarily the art, but is an advertisement for the art, that I think you can become more comfortable using tools to help you keep up with the desires of the algorithm. It's almost like using an algorithm to fight or hack this other antagonistic algorithm so that you can continue to be successful. But I think that hearing messages like that right now in a time of economic anxiety, they're not necessarily well received. People aren't receptive to it.
Yeah. Listen, I mean, it's understandable if people are freaked out about AI.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's inherently freaky, but also, you know, it's been about a year plus that we've gotten this relentless stream of messages about how it's going to either lead to the apocalypse or some kind of post-human, you know, utopia. But I think the way you started talking about it is really quite to the point. I wrote a piece about this where I said that I started by saying AI may put artists out of business, but it won't replace them. So I think we can, I mean, I'd be happy to sort of, we talk about this. It's a fascinating topic. Like, is there something that artists can do that AI can't do? And I think it's a valid argument that there is, and it's not, you don't have to use flowery language. But, I mean, we already set up the next thing I'm going to say, because we already talked about the difference between commercial work that you do mainly to subsidize, you know, your art. Well, the commercial work, obviously AI is going to be able to do this. It's going to be able to do it cheaply. It's undoubtedly already doing it. That's what I mean when I say that it could put artists out of business, even if it can't actually do the most valuable things that artists do. So I think obviously the really sensible way to approach this is a set of tools. How can I use these tools to give, you know, to better give my customers what they want?
I mean, I'd love to go a little bit deeper into the AI topic, because I think there's a lot of myths about, not necessarily the technology. I'm not, you know, the technology is interesting, but I'm more interested in the sort of psychology and sociology about how it will eventually be used, because I see a lot of posts and, you know, like Medium articles and Substack articles and stuff that people are writing where they're very freaked out. They think that, you know, every artist is going to be replaced by one person sitting there, you know, writing prompts and, you know, generating everything. Yeah. And I sit back and I go, it just has never rung true for me, because I'm in that age range that experienced the complete analog to digital world transformation. So I've heard, oh, CG, you know, this is all just the computer doing it. Digital illustration, well, that's not real illustration. The computer's doing it for you. The computer's always been doing it for us, but the computer's never really been doing it for us. And at the end of the day, the CEO, you know, of Warner Brothers, David Zaslav or whoever, he's not going to be sitting there, you know, with a can of Red Bull typing this stuff in, making a movie. Right. I mean, there's still going to be people employed putting forward in creative intent into these tools. So I think a little bit of the doom and gloom may be slightly exaggerated. I do think that it's going to cause and is causing a lot of disruption in a lot of fields, but I don't think it's the complete eradication of the creative worker.
Right. So, I mean, people are ready to talk about, I'll be honest, I have not worked with AI tools. I'm not super interested in doing that, whatever. But from what I understand, crafting a good prompt is already becoming a skill and a valuable skill. And then, of course, working, you know, what the computer spits out. As I understand, a lot of the sort of the AI art that's gotten, the visual art that's gotten attention it hasn't just been, this is what the computer generated, but they generated something and then the artist continued to work with it.
Right.
Or the artist continued to refine the prompt as they saw what the AI was giving them. So the human is going to be part of that, is going to continue to be part of the process. And I'd also say that I think the higher the stakes any kind of creative act is, so, you know, starting at your penny saver thing, which may end up being just completely, you know, AI or some kind of corporate writing or email writing that just, there's no expectation of any kind of quality. Okay, so that might be largely automated. But the more important something becomes, the more of a premium there's going to be, I think, on what only human beings can do, on that sort of human value added, right? So if it's like a big business and there's a lot at stake in the task that it wants you to perform, I think that the human being who can work with the tools to create something of genuine quality is not only going to be able to survive, but I think there'll be a premium. There'll be a premium. I mean, to be honest, this is how I feel as like a 60-year-old writer who's worked on my craft for a long time and sees, you know, a lot of really bad writing because so much content just has to be kind of vomited out. My feeling is, okay, but the more writers there are out there who've only ever done anything, who've only ever just vomited out content at their, you know, website job, five pieces a day, and have never been able to develop their craft, the more valuable what I'm able to do will be. Whether that's actually translated into dollars and cents, okay, that may be another story. But I mean, I think to a certain extent, it does. It does translate. And I would say that for anyone of any age, you know, if you can actually do something well, the more crap there is, the more valuable your quality is going to be.
Yeah, I completely agree with that sentiment. I, you know, in my use of AI tools, you know, I started exploring AI tools long, long time ago because there was this project that Google was doing called Deep Dream, and it was kind of interesting. You had to set it up on your own computer in a janky way. This is, you know, maybe 15 years ago, something like that. And the only thing that it could really generate were these sort of psychedelic magic eye posters that always ended up having like dogs' faces in them. And it was, you know, it was interesting. It's like, oh, that's kind of cool. And you watch the evolution of that into something that could be more focused and coherent. But, you know, it's still not necessarily easy. And I sometimes worry in the sort of macro labor force view that we are focusing a little bit too much on what the impact to artists might be compared to other jobs in society, which will more quickly be replaced with these kinds of technologies. And to me, those are, you know, accounting, to, you know, it could be, you know, things that are that just require, you know, very fast and intuitive calculation in an automated way. Coding, even, you know, that's been this stable bedrock of many, many, many university programs for, you know, quite a long time. Like, hey, you know, get in here, learn how to code, learn how to make apps, go work at a FANG company. But what we're seeing now is we're seeing people getting laid off from those kinds of jobs. And there's a university that I'm involved in, Stevens Institute of Technology, over in New Jersey, right across from Manhattan. It's a really cool kind of school, good legacy. And, you know, they have a good computer science and engineering programs there. And one of the things that we're starting to see is we're starting to see them introduce bigger humanities school. They're trying to get people interested in writing. They're trying to get people interested in these things because the skill of coding is now involving greater levels of communication. You're now going to have to direct an AI to get you the proper result. And that kind of comes full circle back to this old, you know, STEM versus humanities, ROI, college recruiting kind of thing. It turns that on its head in a way. I think that's very
interesting. Period. I mean, I used to be an English professor.
Yeah.
and I have long advocated for the value of the humanities, and not just on a personal level, although I think it's very important, but you know, on a market level. I think this is part of why I don't think AI can replace art or anything, any artistic sort of element or quantum within any kind of, you know, act, creative act, is, again, it's, I don't think we have to resort to kind of spiritual language. I think we just have to think about what we look for in, say, a song, any kind of work of art, or any kind of creative work. We're looking for a point of view. First of all, we're looking for a point of view, right? So you differentiated accounting or coding. My accountant doesn't have a point of view, right? He's a human, but he doesn't account from a point of view, right? So it's specific and unique. It's also personal, right? So it draws on personal experience, and it draws on human experience. And why do I say human? Because they're telling us that AIs are going to, you know, they'll hook them up to arms and legs and noses and ears, and they will have experience too. And that may be true, but I'm not that interested in the, I mean, surely, I think this is undisputable, and anyone who does dispute it, I think, is fooling themselves. Even if AIs become persons, they will be a very different kind of person than a human person. And it may be that the art that they generate from their point of view will be very interesting to other AIs, but not so much to me. Because I look, and it'll be somewhat interesting, but mainly I turn to art to help me understand my experience through the point of view of someone else's experience. That's what it is. And sure, studying the humanities, whether that's writing classes or literature classes, where you're, that's the best way to learn how to write, is to see the best that other people have done, is going to be more and more important, precisely because, as you say, the coding, the machine's going to be able to do the coding. So you need to bring something else to the table.
I think then that's actually a fairly hopeful way for us to kind of close out for the day. I think that everything that you just said is very true. I think point of view is probably the biggest differentiator, making sure that whatever you consider to be a creative output really comes from a level of human experience and human connectivity, right? You're building, even if it's advertising, whatever it is, you're making a human connection to advocate for a message. So with all of that in mind, where can people continue to follow your work, find everything else about you? What's the best way to connect?
I think the best way to connect is to go to my website, BillDerezowitz.com, and you can sign up for my newsletter, which is really just, I send out links to work that I publish. You can find my books. You can find many of the essays that I've published on the essays page. I always post new work on that page. And you can connect with me on some of the social media platforms. And I'm always, always interested in hearing from people directly via email, which you can also find there.
Well, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate the time.
I appreciate the conversation. Thank you.
Visit phantomastronaut.com for all of the different ways that you can help us to continue to create. And I will see you out there.